Wissenschaft und Schule. Ein Podcast der staatlichen Schulberatungsstelle für die Oberpfalz.
Mit Benedikt Wisniewski
und Barbara Gottschling. Wir sprechen mit Experten über Forschung, die für Schule wirklich relevant ist. Kurz und knapp in 30 Minuten.
Folge 3.
Von einer Feedback-Kultur ist heutzutage an vielen Schulen die Rede. Ein großer Begriff, über dessen Füllung mit konkreten Inhalten es sich nachzudenken lohnt. Wenn wir von Feedback sprechen, dann meinen wir in der Regel, einer anderen Person irgendetwas rückzumelden. Dabei kann Feedback verschiedenste Funktionen erfüllen. Bestätigung, Korrektur von Fehlern, die Aufdeckung von Fehlvorstellungen, den Vorschlag von Verbesserungen und so weiter. Meistens konzentrieren wir uns dabei auf die Rückmeldungen, die Lehrpersonen ihren Schülerinnen und Schülern geben, aber zunehmend spielt an manchen Schulen auch Feedback in die umgekehrte Richtung eine Rolle. Dabei zeigt die Forschung für verschiedene Formen sehr unterschiedliche Effekte. Feedback ist nicht gleich Feedback. Manche Formen sind hochwirksam, andere schaden sogar. Aber was genau beeinflusst die Wirksamkeit? Was hilft, was schadet? Und wie kann man Feedback im Unterricht sinnvoll einsetzen? Darüber möchten wir in dieser Folge sprechen. Unser Gast ist John Hattie, Professor für Pädagogik an der Universität Melbourne und Autor der weltbekannten Hattie-Studie. Im Jahr 2007 veröffentlichte er zusammen mit Helen Timperley den wegweisenden Artikel The Power of Feedback, der bis heute Feedback-Standards an Schulen definiert.
Very warm welcome to John Hattie. I appreciate you taking the time.
It's a pleasure to talk to you, Ben.
So, John, what really interests me first is, when did you realize that feedback is such a crucial factor in education and one that needs to be investigated? Was there something like a key moment for you?
Well, in my undergraduate and graduate days many years ago, behaviorism was still very, very dominant, and feedback was a pretty much a dominant notion within that theory. Mm-hmm. But there were major problems in terms of trying to explain what happens with real children in real classrooms. Feedback wasn't as simple as just positive and negative affect. It wasn't as simple as just giving them pieces of cheese or rewards.
Right.
And that was the first part. But the second is, as I started building up the database for visible learning, feedback started to filter up and it became more and more powerful. And I remember in the early 1990s, I was talking about it in Hong Kong, and one of the members of the audience said in a question, well, what actually do you mean by feedback? And that was a pretty confronting question because I thought I clearly understood it, but I struggled to answer it because putting it in a few sentences wasn't easy. And at the time, and I have to confess I was part of the problem, I was looking very much at the giving of feedback, how teachers gave feedback. And like many others, was making claims about all you need is dollops of feedback and lots more feedback. All you have to do is go into a classroom and realize how wrong you are. Teachers already give a lot of feedback. So it's not the problem at all. But when you actually ask students about what feedback they've received, it's measured in seconds a day. And so it was that dawning about that notion of feedback wasn't as simple as I first thought it was, but it started off early. And then, as you certainly know from your research as well, the variability of the effects, like Kluger and Denisi found a third of feedback was negative. You found a fifth of feedback was negative. The same feedback I give you today works. I give you the same feedback tomorrow and it doesn't. So that was really, the power of feedback was a very early observation. But the more and more I went on looking at it, the more and more confused I became.
Well, I'm not even sure if the term feedback as we use it today might go back to a misunderstanding. It seems that the German psychologist Kurt Lewin, who went to an interdisciplinary conference about feedback in the 1950s, heard something about feedback from engineers and then transferred the term to psychology. And maybe he got it wrong. And from then on, we all got it wrong.
I think we did. And certainly, looking at the various kinds of feedback, looking at the way it's heard, understood and actioned by students, is really quite different in terms of its effect. But let me make my mistake here. Feedback is still one of the more powerful influences. And if we could understand the variability and, for example, reduce that third to a fifth that's negative, can you imagine how even more powerful it should be? So I do think it's a really well worth topic of research. I think it's a really important topic for teachers to understand. I think one of the other mistakes that we made as researchers over the years is we tied feedback to cheese, to rewards. Yep. And you still go into schools and they're giving kids rewards or stickers or stars, et cetera. And the kids love them, as I'm sure the rats love the cheese. But it had a very, very limited, in fact, if anything, a negative effect on kids' learning. And that's a fundamental difference between us as humans and some of the animals out there that are looking more for the lower levels of reinforcement. It doesn't work as simple with humans. So trying to understand that too is another part of the picture.
As I understand it, this aspect already emerged in your paper, The Power of Feedback, that you published in 2007 together with Helen Timperley. It is very clear that feedback at the level of personal characteristics is the feedback with the lowest effects. One other thing that always strikes me when I read The Power of Feedback is the realization that effective feedback can only happen when errors are welcome. I think you put it that way.
Well, it's not the only occurrence, but it is the dominant occurrence. Ben, if you get something right, what feedback can I give you? It's very hard to think of giving you particularly corrective feedback or where to next feedback if you get things right. And for many classrooms, the only feedback students get when they get things right is either praise or do more. But if you get things wrong, then that's where it becomes quite dramatically powerful. And so particularly when you look at the different kinds of feedback, like from a student's point of view, they argue very clearly that if feedback doesn't help them to know where to go next or how to go next, they will argue they never got feedback. Despite having a whole page of your comments that you've written that corrects, that clarifies, that adds comments, etc., they will still argue they didn't get feedback. And so this is really where the true power of feedback is from the student who's receiving it, is there's nothing wrong with corrective feedback and comments, but it has to lead to a next decision for the student. And that's where errors, feedback thrives on errors, because if you're making mistakes and you're given corrections about how to rethink differently, how to get different or put together relations between ideas in different ways, that's when the feedback power really, really pays off. Here's the sad thing. In too many classrooms, particularly in our Western world, errors are almost embarrassments and cut back a lot teachers. Now, there was a great study where they looked what happened when a student made an error in the class. Now, teacher asks you a question, Ben, you make an error. Well, 50% of the time the teacher corrects that error. 50% of the time that teacher asks another student who corrects you, and less than 5% of the time, they use that as an error opportunity to learn. Now, if that's what's happening in the classroom, imagine what kids are thinking. Errors are embarrassments. Errors are naughty things, errors you shouldn't make. So too many kids then close off and look like they know, hope they don't get picked on. And this is where they're desperate to get the feedback information. They want to hear how others are thinking that led them to the right answer. And so this is where the notion that failure is the learner's best friend. And Carol Dweck did a really great study a few years ago looking at three-year-olds and what parents did after the kid made a mistake. And it was a very good predictor of what they did when they went to school. If parents corrected them, told them it was wrong, told them they were in any way silly, those kids had really difficult problems when they went through school because they saw errors as mistakes, not as opportunities. And so one of the things we do in our visible learning work, and at the start, we often go into classes and we ask students, and I invite your listeners to do this, ask the students, what do they do when they make a mistake? Now, almost every kid in the world says the same thing. I put my hand, watch them. No, they don't. The only kids who put their hands up are the kids who know their answer or think they know the right answer. the other kids sit there hoping not to get chosen. Once again, those classrooms are not engines of learning. They are engines of compliance. They're privileging those kids who know and dismissing those kids who don't know. And I take the very strong argument, no child comes to a class to learn that which they already know. They come to learn that which they don't know. So this is why we do so much work on trying to make errors normal. Now, here's the good news. And we discovered this about 4 or 5 years ago with Marie Davies' work. Kids today are more likely to talk about what they don't know, ask questions about what they don't know, using social media that they won't do in person, even when the teacher is standing beside them. And I put to you that during COVID teaching, when kids were working from home and teachers were using distance, teachers got to know their students in many different ways because students are more prepared because of their social, why they use social media. Is sometimes for the bad, but they do it. They're more willing to talk about errors. So we're doing a lot of work over social media, getting kids to think aloud, work together to hear each other thinking, work with the teacher, sometimes confidentially with the teachers, sometimes in front of all the kids. And that's been a really, really powerful way to open up this discussion about errors.
So if I understand you right, for more effective feedback, we need a certain climate or a certain culture in the classroom. Just last week, I read a quote on a teacher website saying that the only thing better than feedback is more feedback. Based on what you just said, you might disagree, right?
I absolutely disagree. What we've been working on in the last few years is looking at feedback from the student's point of view. What do they understand by feedback? And I've already commented for them, feedback helps them to know where to go next. And if they don't get that kind of feedback, they will argue they don't get it. But the next part of it is that for a student, feedback needs to be heard, understood, and actionable. And one of the really powerful ways for teachers to check that is for why don't they spend all Sunday writing all their comments, give the students it back on Monday, wait a day so it's not just short-term memory, and then ask the students to write a few notes. What did you understand by that feedback I gave you yesterday? It's really powerful. You'll see that a lot of your feedback is not heard and understood and actionable. So why would you give more of it? And it's really powerful to listen to how the students are interpreting it, and it improves the way in which you give feedback. But it's pretty daunting that a lot of the feedback. Now, the other problem with feedback is that it costs. Now, if you give me feedback, I'm going to may have to do it again. I may have to put in more effort. I may have to do some more learning. I may have to be retaught. I know when I get feedback, I have to do more. So it's easier not to hear it. And for too many students, they learn very quickly. They're not going to get feedback that helps them know where to go next. So why even listen to it? Like, we know from the studies that every time a teacher gives feedback to the whole class, every student knows it's not about them. And so this is why this argument of just give more is the absolute wrong way to go. A lot of the feedback you're already giving is not having any impact. It's not even being heard. So let's focus on that. And maybe we need to, in some cases, reduce the feedback to get feedback that's heard, understood, and actionable. And so keep asking the students, what did you understand by the feedback? You know, everyone listening who's got a teenage kid knows that you have to ask the teenage kid at the end of the conversation, well, did you understand what I said? Because they're interpreting. They're making decisions about what they're listening to and what they're not listening to. That's the case with nearly every kid after the age of about 8 or 9, is they're listening to how it's going to help them, how it's going to make a difference. And in many cases, they've turned off even before they've read your feedback or they've listened to your feedback. So the last thing is more. It's not more. It's more effective. And sometimes we have to be more laser focused.
Okay, you already mentioned the study that we conducted at the beginning of this year. And of course, I would like to pick it up because this study also supports what you just said. Let's briefly talk about our meta-analysis. I will try to sum up what we did for the listeners. So we conducted a meta-analysis of 435 studies dealing with feedback in schools. And in contrast to visible learning, we did not have a look at the meta-analysis, but on the primary studies. This means that we dug a bit deeper, and I think a couple of interesting things emerged. So were there any surprises to you?
Yeah, firstly, for the listeners out there, Ben, you did the majority of the work, so all credit to you here. Going back and finding almost 500 studies makes it one of the largest meta-analyses ever done in education. So, and I know how to do a meta-analysis. It's a lot of work, so all credit to you there. But a few things surprised me. Firstly, the effect size is actually lower in our study compared to some of the earlier studies. Now, I partly put that down to people hearing about feedback and the power of it, and then rushing and making mistakes like, we just need to do more of it. Or in England, they had, I remember meeting a minister, and he told me, he said, you'll be very pleased, Joel, but next year we're going to have the year of feedback. Now, I lost my credibility with him in seconds, because I said, what do you do the next year? No feedback? Not the right thing to say. But they also had crazy things, like they insisted that every teacher write feedback comments at the bottom of every child's work, including at five-year-olds, when the five-year-olds couldn't even read it, but they had to do it. So they did some crazy things. And so just by thinking that feedback can be have more effect by doing more of it, and I think that's what's led to one of the reasons for going backwards, is that we're doing a lot of wrong stuff in schools as a consequence. But I also liked, it wasn't so much, it was a surprise in the sense it was a reinforcing surprise, that the corrective feedback, the where to next feedback, was the most powerful. The one that I still don't understand, Ben, and maybe you do, is why written feedback is higher than oral feedback. That didn't make a lot of sense to me.
Yes.
They're still, both of them are quite high. So there was a bit of an issue in there that I'm sure still trying to explore. And I have a hunch it's to do with when it's written, the students have more chance of understanding it. But when it's oral, they get one chance. But I don't know that for sure. But that's something that we're certainly following up. So what surprised you?
Well, to answer your first question, I think I do have an idea why written feedback might be the more effective form in our data.
Right.
It could be because if you look at the primary studies, we have relatively large overlap between oral feedback and pure praise. And we know that pure praise is the least effective form. And I think it's this overlap that actually causes the higher effectiveness of written feedback. So probably it's not really the medium, but this might be a simple artifact. To your second question on what surprised me, to me, the most surprising fact is high information feedback being so much more effective than the other forms. The more information feedback contains, the more effective it is. But if you look at the effect sizes, the difference is huge, and I didn't expect this. Previous research already pointed in this direction, but it was still surprising to me that the difference is that huge.
I'm just finishing a study now with computer-based feedback using the Turnitin system. And the Turnitin people gave me 3,000 essays that students had written and then received feedback by teachers and by computer systems. They resubmitted them and then got a final grade. So I had two outcomes, the growth between when they first submitted and the final grade and the final grade. And I coded all the feedback using the same kind of coding system as in our article. And what was really exciting going that next step is that the only form of feedback that correlated both with improvement and final score was that where to next feedback, very powerfully. All the others was quite small relative to the where to next. So this really reinforced this notion of that informational where to next feedback is extremely powerful in terms of making a difference both to improvement and to final scores. And I think this is really exciting.
It definitely is exciting. Of course, we can't go into details, but for listeners who would like to know more about this, the paper we were just talking about is called The Power of Feedback Revisited, and it is available via the website of Frontiers in Psychology. So if you want to know a bit more about this, you can find it there. I would also like to talk to you about my favorite topic. We have talked about feedback from teachers to students, but there's of course also feedback in the other direction. You wrote in Visible Learning that you understood feedback better when you discovered that it is most powerful when it is from the student to the teacher. And my impression, and also my experience, is that many teachers are still reluctant to ask for feedback about their teaching. Although there are good instruments to do this and get helpful and valid information about what's going on and how students perceive what's going on. What do you think keeps teachers from asking for feedback about teaching?
I think it's a way of thinking here, and that teachers think their job is to give feedback, and they don't see their job is to receive feedback. And the argument that certainly I want to push here is that teachers need to receive feedback about their impact in terms of what did the students understand and what did they not understand, who, how many students do they have an impact on, and how much was that impact. And the more they are attentive to those from the students. And so, like, when we did our study a few years ago of 17,000 teachers and discovered that they talk 89% of each lesson. Teaching too often is talking. Now, one of the nice things about COVID, again, is teachers discovered if they talked over the internet to their students all the time, the students turned off. They had to move to more triage, where they listened to what the students were doing and thinking. And so I made this comment a few years ago, and it became a headline in a paper, "Academic says teachers should shut up." The next day, a teacher wrote back and said, maybe a teacher says an academic should shut up. But my point wasn't that. My point was that how do you get teachers to listen more to what's happening in the student mind?
Yeah, may I add one other aspect that I think is part of the problem, or maybe even an important part of the problem? I think teachers are pretty much used to getting judgmental feedback and very seldomly get observational feedback. So in other words, when teachers get feedback about teaching, it is mostly about rating them in this or that way. And I think it's a very important reason that keeps teachers from asking for feedback. Would you agree?
I want to go a step further. When I look at the majority of the classroom observation tools, like the Danielson, the Mazzano, and many of the others, 80% of the items in that is about the nature of how you teach. And I take the very strong line, I don't care how a teacher teaches. I care about the impact of that teaching. And so many times when teachers are observed, it's very much about, well, why don't you teach like me? And we've got to be very careful to not confuse the correlates of effective teaching with effective teaching. Like if a teacher, for instance, we know one of the correlates is being organized. Well, some very effective teachers aren't that well organized because they have an incredible focus on receiving feedback from their students. But too much of that teacher observation is focusing on the wrong thing. They're focusing on the teacher when they should be focusing on the impact of the teacher. Now, it's hard to meet a teacher in the world that doesn't have a very, very strong theory about how to teach. Why should we then dictate that they should teach like me rather than teach like themselves? And this is why I say that a lot of that is not just judgmental, it's focusing on the teaching, not on the impact of the teaching. So no wonder teachers get a little jaundiced when they have someone come along and give them pearls of wisdom about how they should teach differently. I'm not a fan of that at all.
Me neither. That's exactly my point. I think it's really not very helpful to tell somebody how to teach. It's much more helpful to provide them with observational data, and I think there are good instruments for this. Certainly not the classic classroom observation tools, but tools for student-teacher feedback that provide the opportunity to get into a dialogue about teaching and learning.
But I want to go a step further, Ben, because if you go back to the study we did together, even stronger is student-to-student feedback. And I think that's really exciting. Now, there's a real issue there, though, because there's a right time for student-to-student feedback and there's a wrong time. If the lesson is focusing on the content, the facts, the subject matter, the ideas, then student-to-student feedback can be very, very low effect size. But after the students have the content and they start to relate ideas, to transfer, to go deeper, student-to-student feedback is unbelievably powerful. Kids are more likely to remember what other students say than what the teacher says. Now, I think this is one of the reasons why you don't have a lot of classroom discussion in many schools, because teachers realize that kids are very, very powerful. And so they close it down to make sure the students have the right information. So I want to make that distinction between when the lesson is about the content, then that's where the teacher should dominate. When the lesson is about consolidating that content and going into the deeper learning, that's when the classroom discussion, student-to-student feedback, really should be more powerful and optimized. Let me go another step, because I think it's a sin to go into a class and observe a teacher teaching. But Graham Nuttall did some really great research, and one of his findings, in fact, the only book he ever wrote was called The Hidden Lives of Learners, because 80% of what happens in your class, Ben, you don't see or hear. Yeah. So I'm not a great fan of teacher reflection on that 20%. What I am a fan of is how do we help the teacher see that other 80%? And that's where classroom observation can be incredibly powerful to help the teacher see their impact. And like Janet, my partner, devised an app a few years ago visible classroom where you can get teacher class and you can get straight as you walk out of the class, you can get a transcript and an analysis of what happened as you're teaching. And it was really interesting. Like most teachers had no idea how much they talked. They had no idea that 90% of what they talk about is facts and content. They argue black and blue, that's not the case. But when they see the transcript, when they see the analysis, now that's a very powerful way, and it's a really great way for teachers to say, well, maybe I need to alter them. Now, we worked with this one teacher. In fact, it was on a national television program. We were with this one teacher who was 10 years into the class, into teaching, and she was terrible, and the kids knew she was terrible. And so we applied this tool to her and pointed out to her, did she realize that in every hour, on average, she said 55 times, shh, shh, shh. And she said, no, I don't. And we said to her, do you realize that every lesson you'd speak 100% of the time? No, I don't. And we showed her the data. The very next lesson, she had no shh whatsoever, and she talked for about 60% of the time. And the kids, we interviewed the kids of that class as they came out, and they were saying things like, what did you do? What happened? That was really good. And they were so polite, but they were dumbfounded that a teacher could change overnight. And it's a rare occurrence, but she did. And so I think this is where helping teachers see themselves through the eyes of the students, not continually seeing themselves through their eyes, seeing their students through their eyes. And this is where all this teacher collective efficacy comes in. How do you get teachers to work together to check on their interpretations about what's happening in their class? And, you know, in our own work, we take a very strong line that in the staff room, the word I can never be mentioned. They're our students. We work together. We need to understand and bring problems to the staff room. And this is where you can really make a big difference when you look at classroom observation to help see the impact, not classroom observation to judge the teaching.
Instead of sending the experts in to tell teachers what to do, you could simply ask the other experts who are already there. You could ask the students, and they will give you very important and valid information.
And the other exciting thing from that is it's most students are actually quite kind.
Exactly.
They hardly ever speak about the personality of the teacher, despite what we think on these things. They will talk about the impact of the teacher. And you're right, they are the ones that are receiving it. They know what's going on. And it's like we do in our work. We start by asking them, what's a good learner in this class? And that's a really powerful way to hear about the teacher. And if they say things like a good learner in this class is you sit up straight, you do the work, you pay attention and you watch the teacher work, you've got a very clear understanding what's happening or what's not happening in that class. But if they say, well, in this class, we struggle, it's hard, it's challenging, and they're quite engaged in the challenge, you know that that's got a very effective teacher in there. And it's really powerful. When you interview those same teachers about what a good learner is, they tell you very rich descriptions. And this is where we're arguing that those rich descriptions that teachers tell, if the students aren't saying that too, you got a serious problem.
Yeah, I see. So this leads me to my last question already. I'd like to know, after decades of research on this topic, is it possible to formulate one core message for teachers about feedback? One thing that everybody should know?
Well, I'm going to cheat and have two. The first is that notion of knowing thy impact. If you continually ask the question about, and you walk into a class and say, my job today is to understand the impact I have on kids. And that begs the three questions: impact about what, impact for whom, and impact how much, which means you have to be open to feedback about those. Let me stop there. I think that's the most powerful message.
John Hetty, thank you so much for the interesting conversation. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. Thank you. And same to you.
Wissenschaft und Schule. Forschung, die für Schule wirklich relevant ist. Kurz und knapp in 30 Minuten. Wir freuen uns über Ihre Rückmeldungen und Anregungen unter feedback@sbopf.de.